Okay, everyone, so now we can continue on the Satipatthana Sutta. So the idea is to finish this off now, because I want to get on to the other things, which are perhaps a little bit more practical. But anyway, it's nice to do the sutta because it is so prominent in the Buddhist world, so I think it's quite useful to have a look at it. So we're just looking at the insight part. So far we have looked at the 31 parts of the body, and then comes this little paragraph called insight, which gives you more information on how this particular contemplation is supposed to be done. So this is the kind of the summary of how to go about this. And this is how it goes. In this way, they abide contemplating a particular aspect of the body internally, or they abide contemplating an aspect of the body externally, or they abide contemplating an aspect of the body both internally and externally, or else they abide contemplating an aspect of the, or rather the arising nature of the body. They abide contemplating in the body the nature of vanishing, or they contemplate in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing, or else mindfulness that there is body is simply established in them to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and they abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a monk, a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, anyone abides contemplating an aspect of the body. So this is how you're supposed to do this mindfulness of the body, the kaya nupassana. This is kind of the instruction. You will see there is like three different parts here. The first part is internal, external, and internal and external. Then there is the arising, the vanishing, and the arising and vanishing. That's the second part. The last part is the one about the bare knowledge and the mindfulness that there is body, you abide independent. Yeah, so it's three different aspects. And of these three different aspects, it is like a natural sequence. The first one is always the most important one and the most basic one. And it's interesting, when you look at the history of the Satipatthana Sutta, that is the one which matters the most, the first part there. And the first part is directly connected to samadhi, to samatha. It leads on directly to samadhi. The second one is more like a vipassana thing, yeah? You see the arising and the passing away of things, more connected to vipassana. And the last one is more like the result that happens when you practice the path in the right way. You abide, not clinging to anything in the world. This is like a very high state of insight, because you release, you let go of everything. But the first part is the most important one, and the reason it's most important is because this is what Satipatthana is all about. It's about leading to samadhi, leading to jhanas, and then after that come the insights. So what does this mean? You do it internally. Internally always means with reference to yourself. Yeah, it's with reference to me, it's my body. So you look at yourself, you think all of these parts in here, yeah, all of these various things. You know that about yourself. So always you start with yourself, because it is attachment to our own body which is the root problem when it comes to attaining samadhi. If you can let go of a little bit of attachment to your own body, then everything becomes so much easier. And then when you have contemplated your own body in this way, then bahidda, externally, means the body of other people's bodies. Yeah, that is the secondary thing. And then the last one is both internally and externally. And what that means is like you have a universal insight that all bodies have this nature. Yeah, there is no escape. It doesn't matter where you get reborn. You cannot get reborn in a place where you are exempt from this. You will always come back ultimately to this kind of body. Because this is just the nature of bodies, the nature of existence. So it is a universal insight. This is the nature of the world. It is inescapable. So if you don't like this thing, it's kind of, you have to get out of it. That is really what it refers to. Yeah, so it is just to, and then when you do that, because as I mentioned before, the purpose of Satipatthana is to help you overcome the last little defilements of the mind, to help you unify the mind. If you contemplate the body in the right way, you let go of the attachment, and then samadhi becomes easier as a consequence. So this is like how then the Satipatthana practice leads to samadhi, because it abandons the last little defilements of the mind. The last attachment to the body goes, and then samadhi can happen from that. Then, so that is the basic practice. The second aspect of the practice here is about contemplating the arising and the passing away of the body, or the vanishing of the body. And this is what this refers to. This is where insight comes, and this usually happens after samadhi. So then you practice the Satipatthana to reach samadhi, and then afterwards you do the insight practices. What does it mean to contemplate the rising and vanishing of the body? Well, what it means is like sometimes you get into a nice state of meditation. Yeah, it's like your body disappears. I'm sure many of you have experienced that. Yeah, there's only the breath left, and even the breath starts to disappear, and you feel a joy in your meditation practice, and things kind of fade away. And that fading away, that vanishing of the body, when it completely goes, it is a very powerful moment, potential for insight. Because when the body disappears, if it can go completely, that is impermanence. Yeah, that is, you really know something is impermanent. Sometimes people think that impermanence means arising and arising and then falling. Yeah, arise and fall of things. But actually, real impermanence, the deepest kind of impermanence, and we'll see this later on also in the Anapanasati Sutta, is things vanishing, disappearing completely, no longer even having access to them, being completely beyond your ability to control. When that happens, that's when you understand impermanence in a very profound sense. So here we're talking about quite profound things. Yeah, we're moving towards very profound aspects of insight. This is what it means when we talk about the vanishing of the body. Gone, yeah, completely gone. No access to it anymore. And then as this insight deepens, that is when the last factor here starts to become strong. You have this bare knowledge and mindfulness, jnana matta patisatti matta, a measure or a degree of knowledge and awareness, and this degree then becomes stronger and stronger and stronger until eventually you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Not clinging to anything in the world is like a very high state, obviously, of insight and understanding. It comes in degrees, but obviously here we're talking about some very high things. So that is this little refrain, and this little refrain, or this little insight refrain, actually occurs after every exercise in Satipatthana. So after everything we do, this is how we actually do the contemplation. It happens in this particular way. Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So that is the Satipatthana practice. So now let us move on to the other Satipatthanas. We're still on the Kaya Nupassana, the contemplation of the body. And there is one other contemplation of the body that is quite nice. I'm going to read that one out as well, because it is one that sometimes can be quite useful to have a look at least. And this is called the Four Elements Contemplation. And it goes as follows. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, layperson, whoever reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, by way of the elements thus. In this body there is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed a cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too this person reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, by way of elements thus. In this body there is the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So this is, again, can be quite a nice contemplation. It is a bit more neutral than the previous one. The previous one, you look at the 31 parts, it can be a bit challenging sometimes. But this one is much more neutral, yeah? All you think of, you remind yourself that this body has all kinds of things, yeah? Earth element is kind of hard. There's obviously air element. It's like when you breathe any kind of air in the body. The heat of the body is the fire element. And of course the water element, any kind of watery aspect in the body. We know it's an easy, kind of simple way of thinking about the body. And of course the idea is that these aspects in the body are exactly the same as the external aspects. When you look at the world outside, it is built up also of those elements. This is the earth element, and then you have the air element and all of this. So our body is exactly the same as the world outside. There is no real difference. Our body arises from this world. When you eat something, the body is built up out of what you eat. And when you die, it gets cremated, it goes back again. There's no distinction there. And after a while, you kind of see your body just as part of nature. It arises out of nature, goes back to nature again. And of course, the more you see that, the less you hold on to this body. There's nothing really there which is yours. It belongs to something else. It belongs to nature. So how can you hold on to something which belongs to nature? It goes through its own things. As you age, you become older, the body kind of deteriorates. It doesn't matter if you don't want it to deteriorate. Usually we don't want that. You look yourself in the mirror and think, jeepers, I'm getting older. But you can't do anything about it. You just have to accept that. This is the problem. So the body has its own nature. And if you try to stop that nature, if you can't deal with that, you're going to suffer as a consequence. So the more you understand that the body just has its own nature, and the nature is similar to the elements outside, you can let go and allow it to take its own course and not be too concerned about it. This is kind of the power of these contemplations. Then you can let go of it, not try to control it so much. One of the nice things about being on a retreat like this that I forgot to talk about or didn't talk about on the first day, I was talking about having the right attitude when you go on retreat. And of course that right attitude is about, gentleness and having a sense of care, all of these kind of things, a very important attitude. But one of the other nice things about being on a retreat is that we... 8 precepts means we don't kind of try to look, really good. We don't use lots of makeup or fancy clothes. We don't worry so much about what we look like. Usually, people tend to worry a lot about what they look like. You get up in the morning, you kind of get ready for work or whatever, but when you come on a retreat like this, you let that go a little bit. And there's something very liberating about that, very freeing, about not thinking about what you look like. Because it takes away a little bit of that identification with the physical body. You become just a person. You just wear some simple clothes, whether it's white or whatever it is. You don't worry about what you look like. And that kind of you fade into the background and you lose some of that identity. And identity is so problematic. It's so painful. Because as long as you have identity, as long as you have a person that you have to be, you have to keep propping it up all the time. You always have to try to be this person. If you think of yourself, this is what I look like, then as you get older, it's kind of painful to see yourself deteriorating as you get older. Or if you have some kind, whatever identity it is, it always creates problems for you because you have to try to live up to a certain standard. And when that is challenged, it's actually painful to deal with that. So when you go on a retreat like this, you have a chance to let go of some of that identity. You are not anyone anymore. You lose some of these things. In one of the suttas that I was going to read out, I'm not sure if I have time, it's called the soil remover, I think it's called. And it's about how to refine gold. And the refining of gold is said to be similar to the refining of the mind. It's quite nice, isn't it? When we are refining the mind, we are really refining gold, because the mind is so precious. You get far more happiness through the mind than you can ever get through gold. Such an extraordinarily precious thing. So if we can refine the mind in the right way, it's like refining gold. And in that refinement process, you start off with the coarse hindrances and defilements. You start by acting and living in a good way with kindness, speaking with kindness. Then you start refining the mind, starting with the coarser hindrances and moving on to the refined ones. And the last thing that the Buddha says you refine is you get rid of all this identity with your nationality, identity with your gender, identity with your work, perhaps, all this identity that we have, yeah? You let go of that. Because these things, this identity, is something that we have to prop up. If, as long as you have identity, you will think about it. It will occupy your mind. You will, you know, this will concern you. But when you let go of that, there's far less to be concerned. And all that is left is this peaceful sense inside, the sense of kindness in the heart, gentleness. And you identify as a kind, some kind of kindness. You identify as metta. You identify with this, you know, this positive being. You don't even know who you are anymore. Identity doesn't matter. Why should we identify so much? It just creates conflict anyway in the world when we identify, because we identify differently, and then we do all kind of stupid things because of this identity. So notice that niceness of just flowing through the day, not having to be anyone, not having to prove that you are somebody, not having to look any particular way. It's such a beautiful way of existing here. And if you can exist more like that also in your daily life, you flow through life so easily. All you identify is the kindness in your heart, the metta, the compassion that you show to other people. That is where your identity is. So this is kind of part of that, letting go at least of the physical identity of the body is a beginning for that. And this is one way of doing that, of contemplating the four elements in this way here. Okay, so enough of that. If you want to read more about the four elements, there's a very nice sutta which is dedicated all to the four elements. It's called the Mahahati Padopama Sutta, the greatest sutta on the elephant's footprint. It's in the Middling Sayings, number 28. That's where it is found. And it talks about this in quite a bit of detail. This is a sutta given by Venerable Sariputta. He was the Buddha's right-hand monk, and he would often expound in detail on the sayings of the Buddha. Okay. It was just Mara interfering a little bit, trying to do something with the microphone. But we challenge Mara straight away. No, give it no chance. Okay, so then you have the same contemplation again. In this way, you contemplate the body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And then the arising, the vanishing, and arising and vanishing. And then independent, not clinging to anything in the world. In this too, you abide contemplating an aspect of the body. So you see your own body in this way, four elements. You see other bodies, and then ultimately you make a universal insight. All bodies have this nature. They are not really anything worth attaching to there at all. So that is the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body. But as I said before, you don't actually have to do any of these practices. All you have to do is watch the breath. And by watching the breath, you are already completing the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body. That's all you have to do. And we will, as I said, we'll have a look at that later on. Now we come to the second satipatthana, is the vedana nupassana. Vedana means feeling, or it means the feeling tone, either positive feeling, negative feeling, or neutral feeling, the three kinds of Buddhist feelings. So this is how to contemplate feeling. And so I'll just read this out, and then we'll comment on it a little bit afterwards. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka, upasika, abide contemplating various aspects of feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, you understand, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, you understand, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, you understand, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. When feeling a worldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand, I feel an unworldly neither painful nor pleasant feeling. This is one reason why sometimes people say, oh, the sutta is so boring. This is why. But But it's all there. One reason why it's repetitive, because it makes you contemplate the sutta as a little better. So what is this all about? What is the purpose of this? So you will notice that the first part here is to understand the feelings. Yes, you know that the feeling is either pleasant, painful, or neither. This is the first thing here. And you may think that this is obvious, but actually this is not obvious at all. This already is actually quite difficult. Of course, if you have a very strong painful feeling, you know straight away. If you have a very pleasant, happy feeling, you know that straight away. But the idea here is to know these things in great detail. Yeah, so you're able to divide the world up into these categories. You know everything about pleasant feeling, everything about painful feeling, and everything about the neither painful nor pleasant. And that takes a lot of understanding, a lot of contemplation to be able to do that. Yeah, so gradually, you uncover this. And the deeper you go in your meditation practice, the more ability you have to see these things. The most difficult one to understand is the one which is neither painful nor pleasant, because this is a kind of a feeling we normally don't even worry about. We don't think about that one. And it's actually hard to see that this feeling, especially when you practice meditation to a very deep extent, that this actually is a very pleasant and very positive experience in your life. Yeah, neither painful nor pleasant feeling are actually the best kind of feelings. They are better than happy feelings. Yeah? You think so? Maybe? Yeah? It's strange, isn't it? This is kind of the wonder about the Buddhist path, and this is why it is so profound. It is so profound because some of the things that the Buddha says are very hard to grasp. How can neither pleasant nor painful be better than pleasant? Everybody's searching for pleasant feelings. How can neither one nor the other be better? And this is kind of the weird thing. You have to experience this for yourself to see this. The deeper your samadhi is, the more profound it is, you start to uncover this. And this is what part and parcel of what this is about. So just understanding the basic feelings actually is difficult enough. Now the other thing which is very important here is this distinction between worldly feeling and what is it called here? It's called unworldly feeling, or if you like, spiritual feeling. Yeah, difference between worldly and spiritual feelings is a very important distinction. And the reason why, oh, paparazzi is coming everywhere. The reason why this is so important is because the worldly feelings are the ones that stop you from making progress on the path. Yeah, the worldly feelings are the feelings that have to do with sensuality, that have to do with all the problems that block us. The unworldly feelings, here, the spiritual feelings, they are the ones that you experience in samadhi practice. When you start to calm down and you start to feel joy in your meditation practice, if that's what you're doing, you're starting to feel the unworldly, the spiritual feelings. That is what this whole path really is about. And when you enter a jhana state, that is when you experience the full spiritual feeling for the first time in your life, and all the worldly feelings are gone. So this distinction is kind of crucial. And once you understand that distinction fully, that is when you understand where real happiness lies in life and what life really is all about, what we should be pursuing and what we should not be pursuing. This is called Niramisa Sukha in Pali. It means literally non-carnal, yeah, non-worldly, non-carnal happiness. And that Niramisa Sukha is the jhana states at the highest level. And I was saying before that Satipatthana Sutta includes the jhanas. That is why it includes the jhanas. It includes the jhanas right there, because the Niramisa Sukha, the happiness which is non-carnal, is right here in the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah, so Satipatthana Sutta actually includes the jhanas. So when someone says all you have to do is Satipatthana to become enlightened, yeah, that's right. But that is because it actually includes the jhana states themselves right there within the sutta. Yeah, so this is kind of an important thing to understand about these feelings. So how do we go about contemplating all these feelings? And then there's many different methods in the Goenka tradition to say you keep on scanning the body and you feel the feelings in the body. Yeah, this is what they say in the Goenka tradition. Is that right? Yeah, maybe it's right. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. But usually the way the Buddha says to experience these feelings is again through anapanasati practice. When you practice the mindfulness of breathing, yeah, the feelings start to arise. You start to feel, as I said before, the joy and happiness. And that itself is the contemplation of feeling, when the joy and happiness arises just by watching the breath. That's all you have to do. And what is so nice about that is that you don't have to worry about the painful feelings. Isn't that great? Don't have to contemplate the painful feelings. Why is it that we don't have to contemplate the painful feelings? And the reason is because you are contemplating them indirectly. If all you experience is joy and happiness, and the painful feelings have disappeared, then you know because that the painful feelings have gone, that is how you contemplate them. Remember, contemplation means understanding impermanence, it means understanding suffering, it means understanding non-self. So when the painful feelings are completely gone, you understand their impermanence. Yeah, they've got nothing to do with you, you have let go of them. You certainly know they're suffering because you are now feeling much more happy. The painful feelings are gone, obviously they are suffering, that's easy to see. And also, because they have disappeared, they have to be non-self. So you don't actually have to contemplate these painful feelings very much. You don't have to sit there, feel painful feeling, painful feeling, painful feeling, painful feeling. You don't have to do that according to the suttas. You can just bypass them completely. And by bypassing them, that is actually how you contemplate them. Is that good news or what? Good news, yeah. This is really nice. And this is kind of the sort of things that you get from the suttas. You don't actually have to go through all of this painful feeling. And this is one of the reasons why I say that in Ajahn Brahm's, I learned all this from Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. He always told, forget about painful feelings, just go for the bliss. I said, yes sir, and that's what I do. And so you should do the same thing. Don't indulge in those painful feelings. Just when you start to have pain or whatever, move, change your position. Yeah, it is not going to be useful. It's going to stop you, hinder you in your practice if you have too much pain. How much insight can you get by contemplating painful feeling? I don't think you can get that much insight anyway. Yes, you can see it arising a bit and passing away, but it doesn't. We're not going to take you very far. Far more insight if you just experience the bliss and then see how the painful feelings have disappeared. That is much more prone, much more potential for insight right there. So this is how you do the Vedana Nupassana. You can see it's interesting. The Buddha doesn't really say exactly how to do this. He just says contemplate the feeling, but it's kind of hard to understand how you do that. So for that reason, it's very useful when he says you do it through watching the breath. When you watch the breath, this happens almost happens as a matter of course, as part of the watching of the breath. Yeah. So what breath again? Come back to the breath. Yeah, everything happens with the breath. So simple. You sit back, you watch the breath, all of this happens by itself. Okay. So then you contemplate these feelings internally, externally, so you know it happens, the same thing happens to others, yeah, not just to you. You know that by inference. Because it happens to you, it must happen to others. In other words, there is no such thing as getting away from these feelings. Everybody has the same problem. And then you do it both externally and internally, and then you do all the other things as well, the inside part as well, especially after you have attained samadhi. So that is the feeling contemplation. Vedana Nupassana. The next one is the Chitta Nupassana. And Chitta Nupassana means the contemplation of mental qualities. Literally, chitta means just mind, but it also means like the qualities of the mind. And this is how it goes. And how everyone, does anyone abide contemplating an aspect of the mind? Here you understand mind affected by desire as mind affected by desire, and mind unaffected by desire as mind unaffected by desire. You understand mind affected by ill will as mind affected by ill will. And you understand mind unaffected by ill will as mind unaffected by ill will. You understand mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion. And mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. Let's just stop there because otherwise it gets so repetitive. Let's just stop a little bit. So here again you have this idea of the mind that is on the one hand defiled, yeah, the defilements of the mind, and the other hand the mind that is pure, that is free from those defilements. And this is what you see again and again in the Satipatthana Sutta. Just before we talked about the worldly feelings and the unworldly feelings, in other words, defiled feelings and undefiled feelings, yeah? Now we have the mind states that are defiled and the mind states that are undefiled. And before we're talking about the body, so all of this, as I mentioned before, is about overcoming the defilements of the mind, yeah? This is why you make this contrast between that which is defiled and that which is pure. So the whole of Satipatthana is geared towards that, purifying the mind, the very last remnants of impurities, to allow the mind to go into samadhi. And this is one of the specialities of the Buddha, if you like, this ability to understand the mind in great detail, and showing you how to overcome this last remnants of problems that block you from going deep in your meditation. So this is what Satipatthana is all about. It drives you towards samadhi as a consequence of this ability to purify the mind. Yeah? So here we're talking about, I don't like this translation so much, because lust is too narrow. It's about desire in a very broad sense. Hate is too strong. Yeah? Hate is like very powerful ill will or something. Actually, it means any kind of ill will. Here it means often very subtle things. The very last remnants in the mind that you try to get rid of. And delusion is kind of okay. But I think more like confusion is often better. You're confused because you have sloth and torpor, or you're confused because you are restless and that kind of thing. It is easier to perhaps grasp what is going on there. So this is the first thing, yeah, to understand fully the defilements of the mind. And again, this is difficult to do. It is hard to fully understand this, because sometimes you sit there and you are so peaceful. You feel so at ease. You feel so relaxed. Maybe you're experiencing some really nice meditation. And you think, wow, this is so wonderful. I can't see any defilements at all. Yeah, and this is the problem. You can't see them because they are so refined. So you have to keep on. If you didn't have any defilements at all, you go into jhana like that. Yeah, and you bang, you wouldn't even know that anyone was in this room anymore because you went into a jhana state. But the fact that you still have a little bit of sensory input, you can still hear something and that kind of stuff, means that you haven't gone all the way. So even if you feel 100% pure, there's going to be some very subtle defilements left in the mind. And this is what stops you from going all the way to samadhi. So the job here is to uncover this, yeah, uncover it by repeatedly applying yourself to just watching the breath. This too happens by watching the breath, yeah, by watching the breath, watching the breath, watching the breath. And as you do that with awareness and clarity, you start to understand with the large, last defilements of the mind, where they are, where the problems are. It's exciting, isn't it? You're already so happy in your meditation, and you know that there's something that blocks you from being even more happy. It's like one happiness upon happiness upon happiness, more and more and more as you do this. It's this remarkable path. You experience things that you never thought were possible before. That is what this is about. It's Ajahn Brahm who has conditioned me to speak in this way. Yeah, he had this book, you know, the book, Ajahn Brahm's book called the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Yeah, and then he has one chapter called Bliss Upon Bliss Upon Bliss, I think it's called. So where he says that it comes a point where you think that there's so much bliss you can't take any more bliss. This is kind of what this path is about. It's just, whoa, too much. I don't know, this is just... And of course you can take it, that's the whole point. This is why this is such an interesting path, because it takes you to things that you thought were absolutely impossible. It all goes in that direction. And you have no choice. You get brainwashed and then it happens. Yeah, simple, right? You just have to sit here and come with Ajahn Brahm and listen to the suttas long enough, and these things just happen automatically. You have no choice. That's good news, isn't it? Yeah, bliss happens without your choice. Wow, that's really cool. So that is the way to look at the Dhamma. Just allow that beautiful brainwashing to happen, and then everything comes to you. So that is the kind of the basic part of this Chitta Nupassana. And then we come to the slightly higher stages. You understand the contracted mind as contracted, and the distracted mind as distracted. So the contracted means like usually tiredness or lethargy. Your mind is kind of contracted inside. Yeah, you're like like you are in prison or something. And the distracted mind, of course, is the mind which is restless, moving outside, not being wanting to be still. So these are like a couple of more defilements right there. And then you understand the exalted mind as exalted, and the unexalted mind as unexalted. You understand the surpassed mind as surpassed, and the unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed, the anuttara citta. You understand the still mind as stilled, and the unstilled mind as unstilled. And you understand the liberated mind as liberated, and the unliberated mind as unliberated. And this, again, is all about samadhi practice. Yeah, liberation here means liberated from the defilements of the mind, the ability to enter samadhi. Obviously, stillness here is samahita citta, is also related to samadhi. Exalted is the mahagata citta, the mind gone great, quite literally. And anuttara means unsurpassed. Yeah, unsurpassed, really, really high up there, the mind. All, again, referring to the jhana states and samadhi states. So again, the jhanas are right there in the Satipatthana Sutta. It is not as if they are separate. If you can look at Satipatthana in a confined sense. In a confined sense, Satipatthana is just the watching of the breath and doing that which leads you to samadhi. But you can also think of Satipatthana in an expanded sense. And in the expanded sense, it includes the jhanas and includes the insights that arise as a consequence of attaining jhana and samadhi. Yes, there's two different ways of thinking about Satipatthana. But here, it is certainly included. So this is the citta nupassana, the contemplation of... hello, Freddie here. And contemplation of the mind. And there are people I know who this is all they do. They do contemplation of the mind at all times, just to make sure their mind is pure, citta nupassana. And so this is kind of one practice you can do. There's one Uttejaniya, a famous monk from Burma, who sometimes comes to Perth and leads retreats. And he does citta nupassana at all times. In other words, always guarding his mind, always making sure that the defilements don't arise. Whether he's walking or sitting, he kind of is a natural part of his practice. Anyway, so then you have the same refrain again. You abide contemplating mind as mind internally, and then externally, and both internally and externally, and the same thing as before. So in other words, in this case, you start off with yourself as usual, then you also know the same thing is true of others, and then you universalize, you know, all minds have this nature of these kind of various states, defilements or whatever. So now we come to the last part, and this is the Dhamma Nupassana. And remember that we are actually, remember that always in the Buddhist teaching there is a sequence, yeah? We're gradually moving up, up and up and up, higher and higher in a sense. And now we have the Dhamma Nupassana. And, let me just start off by reading this out. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects they have? Yeah, I'm not really sure if mind object is the best translation. It is quite hard to translate Dhamma in this sense. But the one way of translating it is as principles. In other words, principles of conditionality is one way of translating it. But don't worry too much about that. We'll have a look at that in a second. So you abide contemplating Dhammas, various aspects of Dhammas. Here, someone abides contemplating these Dhammas, various aspects of Dhammas, in terms of the five hindrances. And how do you do that? Here, when there is sensual desire in you, you understand there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in you, you understand there is no sensual desire in me. And you also understand how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So this here is in large part is about understanding conditionality and causality. Yeah, understanding how it is that that sensual desire arises. And this is one reason why Dhamma here can be translated as principles, because conditionality is one of the basic principles in Buddhism. Everything is conditioned. Everything arises because of causes. Nothing exists independently of anything else. This is what the idea of anatta, non-self, is all about. Everything is relational, exists in relation to other things. Yeah? But the first thing here, just like before, is to know that there is sensual desire in me, or there is no sensual desire in me. And again, don't think that this is easy. It is not easy, because sensual desire comes in large number of degrees. There is very coarse sensual desire. When you are very hungry and you want to eat, that's kind of very coarse sensual desire, and you know straight away that that's sensual desire. But it also comes in very subtle things, like very refined attachment to the body. Yeah, you're going really deep in your meditation, but you can't really let go of the body fully. It's like you are afraid of letting go of the body. Why are you afraid of that? Because you identify it. This is my body. If I let go of it, what's going to happen to it? Yeah? What's going to happen to the body if you let go of it? Nothing is going to happen. Yeah? So it doesn't matter. Actually, the body is much more happy without you controlling it. So please let go. Yeah? It's actually much better that way. But the point is, because we identify with it, it feels like we are dropping it completely. And that is kind of scary. That is what is so hard. And that is a very refined aspect of sensual desire. Because we hold on to our body. We can't let it go. So this is the big problem. And this is why here we uncover these very refined aspects of desire. And of course, then there's the opposite of understanding. There is no sensual desire. And that is what you know only after attaining samadhi, when the mind is completely purified. When you come out of that afterwards, you know, now I understand what real freedom from the hindrances mean. So again, samadhi is kind of implied here. Then, the next thing to understand is what causes sensual desire. Yeah, it says here, understand how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire. You understand this? What is that? Do you know what that is? How is it that sensual desire arises? And the reason why it arises most of the time is because you see the beauty in something. When you see the beauty in a sensual object, desire arises. If you are hungry and you see some nice food, very likely desire will arise, yeah? Because you think, well, I'm hungry, that food looks nice, okay, so desire arises. You're seeing the beauty in it. Of course, it is very true also with people. If you see someone you find attractive, you will desire that person because you find them attractive. This is sensual desire. You're looking at the positive aspect in things. This is how it arises. Or it can arise because of ownership. I own something. This is another way that sensual desire arises. This is my body. I can't let it go. These are my belongings. If you steal my belongings, I hate you because of that. Yeah, because you can't steal my belongings. These are my belongings. That also is an aspect of sensual desire. The ownership, the holding on to things in the world. So you start to notice that. And of course, once you understand this, you also understand the escape. Yeah, you understand, well, if you don't want to get into a relationship with somebody, you have to remember the drawback in that relationship. What is the drawback? Well, the drawback is it's more difficult to perhaps practice the path. Yeah, there's always negative things. The drawback is that one day your partner will leave you at the very latest when you die. That's a drawback. The drawback is that living together is not always happy. Sometimes they're not so happy. There's lots of drawbacks with that. So remember the drawbacks, and then you can let go of some of that desire because you remember the negative side of things. This is how you do that. All you have to do is stop looking for the positive things, and then the desire does not arise. It's easy to say, difficult to do. Why is it difficult to do? Because we need happiness in our lives. We live on happiness. You can't have a life without happiness. It becomes pointless. So what you need to do is you need to develop happiness in a different area. And this is why we have the spiritual happiness. When you develop the happiness in a different area, combined with remembering the limitations of the sensual happiness, that combination makes it possible to move beyond this. This is how it works. So this is why it is so important to kind of tap into that niramisa sukha, the happiness that comes, which is unworldly, that is the spiritual happiness. How there comes to be the abandoning of sensual desire, yeah? So that happens again through how you reflect on things, and how there comes to be the non-arising in the future of abandoned sensual desire. It continues on in exactly the same way by keeping on reflecting in the right way about things, and also by practicing Dhamma, enjoying your meditation. All of that is part of that. But now comes perhaps the more interesting one. This is about ill will. There being ill will in this person. You understand there is ill will in me. There being no ill will in you, you understand there is no ill will in me. And you also understand how there comes to be the arising of unarisen ill will, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen ill will, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. This is actually much more interesting, because ill will is far more problematic and is far more suitable to object to deal with for most people, ill will. So first of all, you know ill will, okay? You know, we probably all know what that means. If there's anyone here who doesn't know what it means, then congratulations. Yeah, you're doing really well. But if you know what it means, which is quite likely, then again, you have to understand the causes. What is it that gives rise to ill will? In exactly the same way as sensual desire, there are very clear causes. And the cause that gives rise to ill will is called the patigasanya in the Pali language. And the patigasanya is the perception of resistance. There's something you are resisting. There's something which is not nice there. You're focusing on something which is not pleasant. So if someone says something to you which is unpleasant, the reason why it appears unpleasant to you is because you are focusing on that unpleasant aspect, and then it becomes a problem for you, and then ill will arises. So the solution to that is not to focus on the unpleasant aspect. Yeah, if someone says something to you which is not nice, instead of focusing on the unpleasant aspect, you feel kind of you feel sorry for the person because they're saying stupid things. You feel, actually, I have compassion for you. Why do you say such a stupid thing? You are the one who has a problem. I don't have to listen to you. Yeah, it's your problem. You don't say that, of course. You think that. If you say it, even more problem, yeah? don't say those things. But you think that, you know, and then you can have compassion. You don't allow the anger to arise, because instead of focusing on the negative aspect, you look at that person in a new way, and you feel a sense of compassion for them, because you know that they actually have a problem. Yeah, so this is how you do this. It's very simple. And there are other ways of dealing with this that I will come back to later on, because dealing with ill will is so fundamental and so important, and it's so freeing when you can let go of some of that ill will. It's so beautiful when that kind of goes out the window, because it makes your life so much more pleasant as a consequence. So again, same kind of thing, with ill will as with sensual desire. You abandon it, and how it comes to not arise again in the future. And then we have exactly the same thing with sloth and torpor, it says it. In other words, tiredness and lethargy, yeah? Tiredness and sleepiness, if you like, restlessness and remorse or regret. So this means like you regret your actions and you're feeling restless or whatever. Doubt, exactly the same thing. In all of these cases, you understand what they are, and you understand how they arise, how they come about, and then you let go of them. And the main way that these last hindrances come about, there is one main way, and that is through the first two hindrances. The first two hindrances tend to give rise to the last three ones. So if all you do is contemplate the first two ones, especially ill will, all the five hindrances are diminished. Yeah, this is kind of the good news. You don't have to worry too much about those last three. Once your meditation starts to get very profound, it can be useful to contemplate those. But if your meditation isn't going super duper profound yet, then it's usually enough to focus on the first two ones. So that is the understanding of the five hindrances. And you can see here it's incredibly detailed. Yeah, it is a very detailed understanding. Yeah? And the reason why it is so detailed is because when you fully comprehend what is going on, it is only then that enables you to abandon these things completely and then get to samadhi. So the Buddha is giving us all the tools that are required for us to let go of this and move forwards into samadhi. This is why this comes here at the very end, just before you enter jhana. There's a tiny little thing that stops you. Yeah, at this point you're already blissed out, maybe you see a bright nimitta, maybe things are going really well, but you can't like do the very last thing. What is stopping you? Tiny bit of restlessness, yeah, a tiny bit of something is what blocks you to go the last bit. And this is the way to uncover that last hindrance that stops you. So, there you are. Then again you have this contemplating externally, internally and all that. It doesn't really make that much sense in this particular context, especially not the arising and passing away, because that's already been covered by the hindrance. But nevertheless, it is there. And this is one of the reasons why sometimes you have grounds for doubting that some of these things are perhaps not as original. And one of the conclusions I mentioned to you before, how when you do the study of this particular sutta, yeah, you can decide on what is the most original aspects, etc. And in this particular part here, which is the Dhammanupassana contemplation of principles, quite likely the most original aspect is the five hindrances, and what comes next, the seven factors of awakening, the bodhjhanas. In the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Pali, there's also the five aggregates contemplation, the contemplation of the six sense bases, the contemplation of the Four Noble Truths. But all of those are quite likely not as fundamental and as important and as original to the Sutta. Most important things, the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening. These are like contrasting pair. Yeah, as the hindrances go down, the factors of awakening come up. Yeah, the less hindrances you have, the more factors of awakening you have. And these factors of awakening are really great. They're really nice and beautiful things. So you contemplate how to get rid of the hindrances, and you contemplate how to give rise to the seven factors of awakening. So let's have a look at these things fairly quickly, because we're going to look at this later on. So again, you contemplate the principles, various aspects of principles in terms of the seven factors of awakening. And how do you do that? Here, when you have the mindfulness factor of awakening, the sati sambhujanga, you know there is the mindfulness factor of awakening in me. Or there being no mindfulness factor of awakening in you, you understand there is no mindfulness factor of awakening in you. And you also understand how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness factor of awakening, and how the arisen mindfulness factor of awakening comes to fulfillment by development. Something's gone wrong there. Something comes to fulfillment by development. Yeah? It's the same principle again. You understand the causality behind these factors of awakening. What is it that gives rise to mindfulness? It is practicing the sila, practicing letting go of the coarser aspect of defilements, and also just relaxing, allowing the mind to rest, and allowing the mindfulness to come about by itself. Yeah, some of the things that I was explaining on the first night here in terms of your meditation practice. Mindfulness just comes. When you are ready, mindfulness arises as a consequence of that. That's how it comes to be. And you understand what mindfulness is. It means you understand the various powers of mindfulness. It comes to many different degrees. There is like weak mindfulness, where you have a rough idea what's going on. And then as you purify the mind, it becomes more and more powerful. And the mindfulness that comes after samadhi is incredibly powerful, very, very sharp. And that is why that mindfulness is the one that is most useful for attaining deep insight. Yeah, because it is so powerful powerful to use. So you understand all the various degrees of mindfulness. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about already, yeah? During your meditation practice, sometimes your mindfulness is weak, sometimes it's strong, and it varies a lot. I'm sure you have noticed that. And that is already part of this insight, understanding the different degrees of mindfulness. And then you do the same thing for the other factors of awakening. So then, after the factor of awakening and mindfulness, you have the Dhamma Vichaya Sambodhanga, the investigation of Dhammas, or investigation of qualities. And this means, this is very similar to what we saw just before, it means understanding the dark and bright states, the blameworthy and blameless qualities, the wholesome and unwholesome qualities. That's really what it refers to. So very similar to what we have just been looking at before. Yeah, because now you're purifying your mind, you're coming very close, very, very close to some, to real samadhi here. So you understand that, how it comes about. How does it come about? It comes about through mindfulness. It comes about through the previous factor of awakening. The next factor of awakening is energy. As you abandon these defilements of the mind, energy starts to arise. These seven factors of awakening is a natural sequence, one following upon the other. You feel energized. The mind brightens up, yeah? And you start to feel the energy of the mind. You feel really powerful. Yeah. Ajahn Brahm once said, you feel like a nuclear reactor. Have you ever felt like a nuclear reactor before? I'm not sure what it feels like, but it probably sounds, it sounds like very energetic. So you feel a bit like a nuclear reactor. And then, when you start to feel like a nuclear reactor, this is just a small nuclear reactor now, and it becomes larger and larger as you move along. And then you get the Piti Sambodhanga, the factor of awakening, which is rapture or joy. Then from the Piti Sambodhanga, you get the Pasaddi Sambodhanga, the tranquility factor of awakening. From the tranquility factor of awakening, you get the Samadhi Sambodhanga, the stillness factor of awakening. From the stillness factor of awakening, you get the Upeka Sambodhanga, the factor of awakening, which is equanimity, the mind being completely equanimous, completely powerful. This is when you become a large nuclear reactor, yeah? The nuclear reactor becomes larger and larger. So, and the nice thing about this particular nuclear reactor is that you cannot have a meltdown. There's no meltdown in this nuclear reactor. It is very stable and very powerful. So no meltdown is possible with this nuclear reactor. Very, very stable. And that is why, when you come to this point, this is where real insight can happen. You have the energy, you have the joy, you have the stability, all the factors come together. And this is how the Satipatthana works. Understanding the causes, understanding what these things are, understanding how they come about. And all you have to do is, guess, watching the breath. That's all you have to do. Yeah? And this happens automatically as you watch the breath. So simple, so easy. But not simple, but also sometimes it doesn't happen. Yeah. So what we have to do is make sure that it happens. So that is the Satipatthana Sutta for you, explained in brief. You really could expand on this a lot, because the Satipatthana Sutta, there's so much to be said about this. But I don't want to make it too theoretical. I want to keep it reasonably practical, because that is what this any meditation retreat really should be about. So again, I hope this makes sense to you. If it doesn't make sense, please try to ask some questions later on. But just to remind you again very briefly on the main aspects of Satipatthana, the things that really matter, the things that you should keep in mind as you do this practice. Remember first of all that the cause, the thing that is most important for Satipatthana to become to be possible, is the purity of the mind. Yeah, so you have to purify your virtue, your sila, as much as you possibly can. Be kind, yeah, and put a lot of emphasis into kindness. The way you think, the way you interact with people around you, the more emphasis you put on that, especially on how you think, the more ability you will have to be mindful, and the more powerful your meditation will be. Sila is the real power source that allows meditation to happen. Quite simple. That's really all you have to remember in daily life. The other thing to remember about Satipatthana is that it leads to samadhi. The purpose is to get you into samadhi. Yeah, that is what it is going to. So it is like the last purification of the mind. And the third thing to remember is that the easiest way to practice this is just to watch the breath. All you have to do is watch the breath. So what I said before, that all you have to do is to be kind. Yeah, then watch the breath, and then reach awakening. That's all you have to do. It's actually, I was quite serious about that. That is really all you have to do. Except that it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance to be able to do that. But apart from that, the idea is very simple, yeah? So if you can just remember that much, be kind, watch the breath, and then awakening. Can you remember that? Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't, right? This is the problem. We forget everything. In daily life, we get so busy, everything goes out the window. You forget about being kind, and then something goes wrong. So you have to kind of keep on coming back to these teachings again and again and again. And gradually, they start to grow on you, and things start to happen. I'll talk more about this maybe at the end of the retreat, how to ensure that you can remember at least one thing. Yeah, at least one kindness. I also sometimes forget to be kind. I feel really bad when that happens. It's terrible. So we have to kind of bring it back to the front again and again. So, that is it for now. And tomorrow I'm going to go one step backwards, because now we have gone a long way down the path already. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about one of the standard things that I talk about on every retreat, which is how to overcome ill will and anger. And this is such a beautiful little sutta. I love this particular sutta. It's very powerful. And I think a lot of people find this very useful in how to reduce their anger. So now we're going to be a bit more kind of hands-on and practical, hopefully, and do things that will be hopefully relevant to your life as a Buddhist. That is all for now, and we'll see you again at 7 o'clock this evening.